Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody really believes, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Dr. Donald Gibson is a Marine, doctor of chiropractic, and world champion trap shooter. This man I have known for over 20 years now, was born in South Africa, came over here, brought that South African mentality, that work ethic, and that sense of humor into an arena that allowed him to flourish no matter where he stood. Donald, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It feels like it was just yesterday that you and I were in the back of a Combi eating biltong, walking over to where my dad had just shot his first kudu. It was.
I was with him that day.
Yeah, pretty special. He will never forget that experience. And there's something about hunting in South Africa that's a little different than hunting in the United States. In the U.S., we get in a tree and we just wait and we put a salt lick and a buffet for the deer to walk up to, and then we shoot it. South Africa is different. Tell us what it feels like to not be at the top of the food chain when you go on a safari.
It's a humbling feeling, and you have to pay attention to everything. It's not just the animals. It's, well, you know, talking about lions, leopards, whatever. Even some of the herbivores would like to take you out if they can. So snakes, spiders, all kinds of things. It's just a totally, totally different environment from what you're used to over here. Way more dangerous.
Yeah, way more dangerous. And again, when you go, you're going to have a professional hunter with you, and you're going to have probably indigenous people with you as well. Mm-hmm. And even within that, there's the dynamic of understanding, what's this pH? What's the professional hunter saying? Yeah. How are they responding? Are they pushing back? Because that indicates either how far we have to go, if we're in danger, if we need to be taking the shot now, or if we just need to get back and start hoofing our way back towards the vehicle.
Most of the time in the United States, if you get a guided hunt, the guy that's taking you doesn't have a rifle. Or sometimes if you go in the mountains for elk, they might have a pistol because of bears or mountain lions or whatever around here. But in Africa, at least the professional hunter, as well as you, always has a rifle. If not more than some of the indigenous people that they take as well, they might also be carrying weapons because of how dangerous it is down there. So
I remember Chris telling us stories about how he had a leopard that backtracked on them. And if it wasn't for those people knowing what was going on and seeing it and basically smelling the danger, he wouldn't have been able to have a conversation with us. So
yes,
it's amazing.
That's correct. That's correct. Yep.
So spent a long time learning a lot about life, going through some hardship. And Don's been a big inspiration for me. He's always kept me grounded, always had my back when I really needed it. And that meant the world to me. And now seeing you do so well, not only as a professional chiropractor, as an entrepreneur with a couple of offices that are doing well, it's amazing. We were saying how that quality has a quantity all its own. And in today's day and age, people seeing a chiropractor that will actually take a film, look at it, measure it, go through, do analysis, find where the subluxation is on the body, because you can see misalignment on a film, but not necessarily nerve impingement. But that's something that, while it may seem simple in today's day and age, is something that is often overlooked. And I think that, again, as BJ said, an adjustment is only as good as it is specific. So tell us about your introduction to chiropractic. There's a lineage there. And then tell us about what continues to be your driving force behind that.
Yeah, as far as my lineage goes, so my dad's a chiropractor. My mom was his secretary for a long time. So I grew up in a chiropractic office. My dad got a job teaching at a chiropractic college and did for 22 years. So after growing up in an office, then I grew up in a chiropractic college. We used to get pulled out of school for some student that would need a physical or an x-ray or whatever. So I've grown up around it. I've seen every person with a bright idea of how they were going to change this and that and do it different come through the school. And it all goes back to one fundamental basic, in my opinion, which is find what the problem is, correct it, and then leave it alone. You know, just like the greats have said and have taught us. And so that's my lineage, is growing up with a father who understood that and gave that understanding to me. And now in my own way, I'm able to take that into my professional life with modern tools, things like that, and a lifetime of understanding, and apply it to what my patients need. And to answer the second question there, what I do here and what I tell people, you know, is oftentimes chiropractic is overlooked. And you, like you said, it is kind of, it's simple, but it's not. And so how I've taken my past into the future, into what I'm doing now, is I've basically taken a whole bunch or a lifetime of inflammation. Yeah, where's my head? I've taken a lifetime of information, and I can condense it down into a few minutes of a talk with somebody to educate them on their own body and their own physiology. And then I can demonstrate that and how things work by taking the x-ray, showing them where the problem is, showing them the anatomy that's involved with that, not just along the spine, but also the nervous system, musculoskeletal system, so on and so forth. And then I correct the subluxation based on what we saw on the film and in the exam. And then the patient goes, oh my gosh, I feel better. But you know, when you explain it to them correctly, people will say all the time, oh, that makes perfect sense. And I go, right? It's just anatomy and physiology. I don't have any magic tricks. There's nothing I'm pulling out of thin air. I'm not healing you. I'm not curing you from anything. I'm simply adjusting the spine or putting it back to where it belongs so your nervous system can function as close to 100% as possible. And it's amazing to see the changes that you see in people. But basically, that's what I do. And I focus so much on that aspect of chiropractic, educating my patient, because what I want for them is, you know, I tell people, again, it's not about me. This is about you, but I'm informing you of this. I'm taking the time to show you what this is, because in today's day and age, we're often so many times told, this is what's wrong and this is what you need to do. And the patient on the receiving end doesn't have an education or isn't well informed about how their body works. And they'll take that information and run with it, oftentimes doing more harm to themselves than they're doing good. My goal is to educate you based on what we see on the film and based on anatomy and physiology, again, which isn't my idea, so that you can make a more empowered decision about your own health in the future. That's what matters the most to me. You may not come to me again. You may never visit me again. But if you understand how things work and something goes wrong, you may go, wait, instead of taking this pill that's bad for my liver or kidneys or whatever, or getting a surgery that you can't reverse or whatever, you may in your mind just say, maybe I should go see somebody that's less invasive or whatever, or can take an x-ray and tell me maybe there's a problem there. You know, just it allows them to make a more informed, more educated decision about their own body by giving them the basics about how it works.
And that's so key. The power that makes the body heals the body. As you're saying, from a chiropractic standpoint, when we remove the interference, the body's able to do whatever it needs to do. It's a self-healing, self-regulating organism.
Yes.
However, like you say, that's not as easily advertised or monetized as a pharmaceutical. And I found out recently, the United States is the only country, I think there's one more, that actually allows people to advertise directly to the consumer.
Yes.
With pharmaceuticals. But when you go to South Africa, when I went to Europe recently, it's the same thing. They look at you and they were like, do you see a conflict of potential interest there, where this person is more concerned about saying, ask your doctor if so-and-so is right for you? It's like,
yeah,
that feels a little bit maybe that may not have our best interest in mind.
I had a conversation with a medical professional, and for, I don't want to get them involved. And so I won't tell you what their title was, but they do have a doctorate in the medical field. And this person was standing in my office one day and made the comment and said, well, this is a good form of secondary medicine. And I said, okay. And I said, first of all, can we have a conversation, but let's have an educated conversation about this. I said, so let me just be clear. I have nothing to do with medicine. I don't prescribe it. I don't have anything to do with it. I'm not against it. I'm just saying I don't deal with medicine. So this isn't medicine at all. This is chiropractic. But if we're going to have this educated conversation, can we just talk about anatomy and physiology? Let's take ego. Let's take profession. Let's take all of that out of the equation and talk about the one language that is universal, in healthcare, which is anatomy and physiology, whether you're a PT, MD, DC, DO, whatever. Anatomy is anatomy is anatomy. It doesn't change. That being said, I asked this person, so what you're telling me, if this is a secondary form of healthcare and your medicine is supposed to be the primary form of healthcare, what you're telling me is that if I have an ailment of any kind, a headache, a sore knee, a sore foot, a backache, if I've got nausea, if whatever, my first option should be to go take a pill or do physiotherapy or get a surgery that I can't reverse as my first option for whatever's ailing. The person said yes. So I said, okay, so if we are to talk about this from a purely anatomical perspective, if in fact the brain and the spinal cord control and regulate every single function in the body down to a cellular level via neurotransmitters, and it's the only organ system in the body completely encapsulated in skeletal bone for its protection because of how important it is to your function, wouldn't it be more appropriate to perhaps check that one chain, the one structure that surrounds the central nervous system or the organ that's responsible for everything, all communication in the body? Wouldn't it be more conducive and healthier to check that first or primarily before you take an external substance, ingest it, take a shot, or have a surgery that you can't reverse? Wouldn't that make more sense? And the response I got was, huh,
that's it.
But when you think about that from an anatomical perspective, that's right where my mind goes. Look to the source of where the information is coming from. Find out if there's a problem there. If there is, fix it. If it doesn't go away, you probably have something else that you need to go see somebody else for.
That's it.
You know, it's not about, yeah, to me, it's not about, hey, let's fight over money. Let's, you know, my ego needs you to come to my office because I do this. It's, and in my opinion, the number one question that's been forgotten in healthcare, and it's the most important question, and every profession has forgotten this, but what is in your patient's best interest? That is what matters the most. When they come into your office, they don't care. Well, I guess they do care what kind of doctor you are, but they're there for your help. So if you can help them, help them. But if you can't help them, send them to somebody who can. Do what's in their best interest, not the best interest of your pocketbook, your ego, or whatever organization you're working for, so that you can keep getting them in and making money and so on and so forth. That's one of my things, is one of my goals is to do what's in my patient's best interest, no matter what.
And that's the key. We see that it only takes 10 millimeters of mercury of pressure to inhibit a spinal nerve. And it's five now. Or I got it wrong.
Yeah.
5 millimeters. All right. So
5 millimeters of mercury pressure are about the weight of a dime can reduce a nerve's function up to 60%. And guess who figured that out? It wasn't the chiropractic profession.
Neurologists, right?
Yep. Neurologist medical profession basically did the research on that. So, so they know.
Yeah, they absolutely know. And as you were saying also, if you have a system that does not benefit from you getting better, then again, what are you trying to find? These are people that are, they're intentionally trying to not fix you. Or again, even the word diagnosis, think about it. It's literally their best guess. They'll give you a diagnosis based on symptomatology that they recognize, and then give you medication based on that and say, check back with me.
Yes. Yes.
And if that doesn't work, then they're like, oh, well, my initial diagnosis was incorrect. Let's try this. But again, that's not necessarily in the patient's best interest. And it would almost be like going to a mechanic and saying, my car won't start. Can you help me? And they're like, we're going to change your battery and your alternator, but maybe that's not what the real problem is. And all of a sudden they're saying, well, I guess my diagnosis was wrong. We're going to have to change your transmission or whatever it is. So understanding the way it all comes together is absolutely key.
Yes. You know, I've even had this conversation with physiotherapists, because there's this big thing with physiotherapy and chiropractors where they think they can do what we do. And there's this big contention there. And I had a conversation with one day, and I said, again, let's break this down anatomically. So, you know, first off, let me kind of backstep a minute. If you want a diagnosis for something, why would you go to somebody trained in medicine for a knee problem? They're an expert in medicine. You know, look at the credit hours. Look at what their education is in. Instead of going, well, I'm going to go see the real doctor, which I've never seen a diploma that says that, by the way, in any doctorates. I've never seen that. I'd love to see one. So if anybody can bring me one that says that's real, I want to see it. I want to take a picture of it. And then I'll tell my patients, I found a real doctor. Anyways, I the only reason I'm telling you this is I hear this all the time in my office from my patients. They'll go up there for a musculoskeletal problem, but they'll go see somebody trained in medicine, you know? So I tell them the same thing. I'm like, well, if you want a musculoskeletal diagnosis, you can go to a PT, a chiropractor, so on and so forth. Now, segueing into the conversation I had with the PT, I said, again, somebody comes to me for chiropractic or they go to you, you tell them not to go see the chiropractor, you can help them and you're going to exercise this muscle. Say it's the IT band or whatever. So if we were to look at this from an anatomical perspective, why is that muscle weak? Did it just give up one day and said, I'm done playing. I don't want to do this anymore. Probably not, right? So if you look at it from an anatomical perspective, what does a muscle attach to? Two places, right? Origin and insertion, a beginning and an end. So I said to the physiotherapist, why would you exercise a muscle that's weak? Well, to make it stronger was the answer. I said, but anatomically, if the origin and insertion isn't in the correct anatomical position, that muscle's either going to be too long or too short. So why would you exercise that muscle if the origin and insertion aren't in the correct position? Why wouldn't you correct the origin and insertion so that the muscle can hold a normal shape, then exercise the daylights out of it? Wouldn't that make more sense? Huh.
Absolutely. It all makes sense when we start seeing it come together like that.
Yeah. And I just tell people again, it's not just necessarily about chiropractic, but just think about it for a second. Think about the anatomy involved, you know? And the answer, you can get a lot better care that way, I think, is my point.
Absolutely agree.
But anyhow, so that's my spiel on that.
No, I love it. And where's your practice? Where do you practice?
I practice in Havre, Montana.
Okay.
Yep. If you look it up on MapQuest, it'll say Havre or Havre. But it's Havre, Havre. Yep.
And we'll send people to the Facebook later on in the conversation.
Okay.
I didn't mean to skip over it, but you're also a Marine. Tell us about how your life in the Marine Corps, what were some of the most important lessons that you got out of that you still apply today?
Let's see. That's hard to explain. It's been so long ago. But when you go into something that is so structured at such a young age and you're impressionable and you understand that there's a routine, that there's a way to achieve excellence or a way to achieve a goal, and it's laid out for you like the Marines do it in an organized, methodical way, you take that with you later on into life. And then anything I do, whether it's my trap shooting, whether it's my business, whatever, it's organized, it's methodical, it's thought out. I look at every angle. I look at my surroundings. I look at my environment. I assess the situation, and then I plan accordingly. And I think if anything, that's what I carried from it. Also, you know, how to be a professional, how to look professional, dress professional, speak professionally, act professionally, those sorts of things. How to carry yourself, you know, life lessons that at the time, I think you're too young maybe to understand what they mean later on in life. But it's certainly made a huge difference in who I am today and how I live my life.
I remember talking to you when you were transitioning out and you had just gotten back into the civilian sector, and we would have conversations and you would say something along the lines, which I didn't really understand it until I was in the military and got out, the same thing where you would get up and it was like, I've already done these things. And sometimes it's hard for us because we're used to leadership laying down, this is what you're supposed to do. These are the objectives, this is the mission, this is what you do. And for many of us, that transition into realizing, oh, I'm leadership now. Oh, yeah. I'm the CEO, I'm the CO, I'm the one that gets to decide, I'm the battalion commander. And I'm like, this is what I want to do. But so many people that transition out, even when I heard David Goggins speak, he was talking about how that even SEALs, even these top tier operators, once they get out of the teams, even 90% of them go into this like mediocrity. Yep. They get soft. They're not applying those things. So it shows us that, yes, having the military background is key, but these principles, these ethos, they can serve us in any environment if we are willing to be smart enough to look in the direction we want to go to, which many times that's hard. It's the scary part for many of us. Once you get out, if people are saying, well, now that you have this experience, you can go get this job, or whatever. And even in chiropractic school is very challenging. Having said that, if you are a young chiropractor that gets out and then you're thinking, okay, this is it. I've already done all the hard work. It's almost like getting an MBA. You have all this debt. You have this piece of paper and it's like, you should be incredible. It's like, no. Now you have to go out and do probably the hardest thing in your life, which is build a practice, shake hands, hand out cards, make sure that people understand what you do, and then be willing to get up every morning and maybe have an empty office or maybe have one appointment or maybe say, how am I going to pay overhead? How can I afford my x-ray machine? How can I afford a secretary? But this is very much that entrepreneurial journey. And what we choose to do in the face of adversity is an indication of how we will be in anything else that happens in our life, good or bad. So tell us about what it was like to begin to create a practice that you built today. Because there's a lot of entrepreneurs out here that are either they have something as a side hustle and they're like, I want to stop this job to get into it, but there's a lot of things to consider. So it is scary for sure.
Looking back, I remember I spoke at a seminar once. They introduced me and told them how well I'd done and whatever. And so I had a bunch of students come up and say, can we get a copy of your business plan? You know, how did you do it? Blah, 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 blah. And the first thing I needed was a place to practice. You know, I needed to find a space where I could set up. And I actually started with a metal folding chair and a portable table. And I borrowed $7,000 to get my computer, my paperwork system, and so on, and a chair and a desk to get going. And at the time, I still had the same mentality, but looking back, I didn't know what it meant. And that, you know, when asked later, you know, what's your business plan? How did you set this up? What was your mission statement? And they're like, can we get a copy of that? And I said, you know what? I'll write it on a sticky note for you. And I give me one of the small ones because it won't take much. And I said, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what profession you're in, what business you're in. If you provide a quality product for a fair price, you'll be busy. So my goal from the very beginning, I didn't know how I was going to get patients. I'll tell you how I got my first patient. But I didn't know how I was going to get patients. I wasn't into the Facebook advertising thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know much about it. What they teach in schools now is advertise, 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 Facebook, pay Google $500 and you'll be the first one on the list when anybody looks it up. Blah, blah. I didn't do any of that because I knew if I provided a quality product for a fair price, the phone would ring eventually. So it was January 14th. Actually, January 14th is my 10-year anniversary of having my license. January 15th is my 10-year anniversary of my first patient. So I got my license in my hand. Walked upstairs to the guy who I was renting from. And I said, hey, just wanted to let you know, I got my license. The next day, I get a phone call from his daughter, who became my first patient. And it just went from there. So 6 months later, I went from living below the poverty line for, 3 years to where I'm at now. So, yep.
That's incredible. Yep. And it's a testament to everything. The coaching practice that I have now is the same way. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of coaches in the space where, again, online, you can look like a huge success online if you're willing to borrow enough money to get that appearance. But as you said, what happened was I started helping people and seeing their blind spots and calling them on their BS and giving them that accountability. And then also telling them the things that maybe they didn't want to hear. And that's, like you said, that's truly valuable, especially to a CEO that has 50 to 100 people with them, they're making all this money and they're surrounded by yes men. If you can be that single person that can point out the thing that nobody else will say to them because they're concerned about their paycheck, then that's worth its weight in gold every single time it happens.
I never did. My mind and my heart was never on the money. It was about helping the person. That's what mattered the most. And again, I knew that I knew if I could do that, that things would happen. And so, pardon the pun, but it boils down to actions. You know, I did it. I didn't just talk about it. I didn't put it on my Facebook page that my mission statement is to help my patients and to provide the best quality service available. I didn't do any of that. I just did it. I didn't talk about it. I just did it. And then that's, you know, yep, exactly. Things just that happened faster and faster and faster. And I think last week was my slowest week, or 2 weeks ago was my slowest week in 8 years. It's just been insane, you know, so.
It's a good problem to have. For those that don't know, you didn't just pick up a shotgun and all of a sudden you're a world champion. Because I remember you shooting years ago, but you had, it was interesting. I remember your father making a comment that you were sort of a natural with a shotgun, but there are, let's be honest, there are many people, because I've seen it in every arena, martial arts, competitive fighters, the military, entrepreneurship, where there's a lot of people that have some natural proclivity, but this is what I have found. They do well in an environment where they naturally do well, where they naturally dominate. Then you click them up a notch and say, okay, let's see what you look like at the national or the international level, or let you in the open market and see what you got now.
Yeah.
And lots of times what's happened is they build this cognitive bias or this cognitive dissonance that says, I'm the best. It's always been easy for me. This shouldn't be that hard. And then when they run into people that actually are as talented as they are, and then they added this other thing called work and mastery of the skill set, all of a sudden it's much harder. And then that person that's like, why is this so hard? I'm really good at this.
Yep.
What's happened is instead of making them better, instead of giving them that catalyst to get stronger, to give them the challenge that they embrace, it actually makes them say, you know what? I could do that, but I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And now they subconsciously hold back. They don't push themselves the way that they need to. And instead of letting their ego kind of get put to the side, they hold on to that. And now they build nobility around that idea that, you know, I could do that, but I don't have the time that this person does, or this person's put in more time, or this person's sponsored, or this person has this weapon, or whatever it is. You and I understand that it does not matter. I could put an old rifle that I found in a pawn shop in your shoulder, and I'm sure that you would shoot much better than I would. And that has nothing to do with, again, the instrument, as they would say. So you had that initial love for it. And then I understand life happens. What got you back into shooting? And then we'll continue into your mission there about mastery, about peak performance. These are many things that I've seen because I've interviewed Olympic gold medalists, world champions in many arenas. And I think your story is fascinating in that capacity. So what got you back into it?
Actually, I had a patient who's a Vietnam vet who came into my office one day and he said, Doc, we need somebody to shoot on our league team, trap shooting league team locally here. And I said, I haven't shot in 20 years. I only shot a little bit in high school. You know, I don't even have a shotgun, which I didn't at the time. And I said, so I don't think so. He goes, you can borrow my gun. You know, I'm like, I'm not going to borrow anybody else's. I appreciate it. Blah, blah, blah. Let me think about it. And I called my accountant and I asked her, I said, if I sponsor a local league team, you know, for trap shooting, is that a tax write-off? Yep. So I went across the street, bought a shotgun and showed up at the trap club. And that was in 2018. And I just started shooting the local league. And I did okay, you know, and it had been a while and I did okay. And while that happened, I realized, you know what, I still kind of enjoy this. So I shot a little bit of competitive, not more than 1,000 targets in a year, competitive shooting, which isn't much. I did that in 2018, 2019. And then in 2020, I went, man, I'm really in love with this sport. I used to play rugby. I played rugby for 20 years. I think I won 2 national championships. I can't remember, something like that. Anyways, I love to just compete. I love the environment. I love the people. But in this particular case, I thought, well, you know, what was that? Yeah, I was pretty close to 40. and I went, this is really a non-physical sport. There's people of all shapes and sizes. I've seen people in wheelchairs. I've seen people walk out with a stool and an oxygen tank and kick my butt. You know, no joke. Mm-hmm. So I realized I didn't have to be this super physical athlete to participate in this. And this is something I could enjoy for the rest of my life. So I went, you know, I think I'm going to just get into this and maybe get a little bit more serious about competing. So for 2018, 2019, I didn't shoot more than 1,000 targets in a year. And I think it was 2020, I went, I'm taking this serious. Started going to some of the more national level shoots. You know, they say as far as being a natural, sure, maybe that helps. Maybe it does. But I realized that if I wanted to compete at this, I had to put in an awful lot of work, natural or not. So I started putting in the work, and I think I shot something like it was 1,500 or almost 2,000 targets in 2020, and I did really well. And then in 2021, that might have been 2021. Anyways, each year I started shooting a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And I realized last year that I wanted to compete at a higher level. And so I wrote down on a sheet of paper some of my goals. And the last goal was at some point in my career to win something at the world championships. And that was last year I wrote that down in 2023. And so anyways, that's kind of how I got back into it. And through the people that I met, I realized that it's a great group of people. I love the community. I love the friendships I've made. I get to go to Phoenix. I've gone to Illinois. I've gone to Utah, all over the place to shoot. And yeah, that's how I got back into it.
And so tell us about when you actually were in the Class A competition and tell us what happened. Because yeah, for some people that may not understand all the specifics about shooting, you know, that many, what a handicap is with a, you know, shooting with a partner, all these different things. Explain what happened and then explain the significance of what that was.
Okay. So at the World Championships, it's held in Sparta, Illinois, every year in August. And it's the largest trap shooting venue in the world. On the day that I did what I did, if I remember right, there were over 2,500 competitors. Wow. Now there's different classes in trap shooting based on averages. And again, so when people say, how long have you been shooting? I'll say seriously, competitively, about 3 years, going into my fourth year now, where I've really made an effort to really compete at the sport. So that Sunday, so I got there, I got there on a Friday, I shot Saturday, and I shot Sunday. The Sunday morning that I shot was the preliminary world championship event. Preliminary championship Sunday. So there's the preliminary championships, and then there's the world championship, which is the following weekend, Saturday and Sunday. What happened was that morning, Sunday morning, I got up, and I've never broken a perfect score out of 100 in trap shooting ever in any discipline. There's three different disciplines. There's singles, doubles, and handicap. Singles is where you shoot one target at a time, five per post from the 16-yard line. You shoot 25, then you move to the next trap, shoot 25, move to the next trap. Usually that's out of 100, but at these big competitions, it's out of 200 targets. Anyways, so that's the 16-yard line. Then you have what's called the handicap event, which is also based on your performance. You start off, when you initially start shooting handicap, you'll start at the 19-yard line. You have to usually break a 96% or higher to move back. So the goal, the furthest back you can go, is the 27-yard line. I'm currently on the 25.5-yard line. So, and I started that about 3 years ago. So I've done pretty well. There's guys that have made it a lot faster than me, so on and so forth. But that's what handicap is. So you shoot further back than the 16-yard line based on your ability. And that's a separate event out of 100 targets. Then doubles is where you shoot two targets. The two targets come out of the trap house at the same time. And you shoot those from the 16-yard line, and that competition is based out of 100 as well. So Sunday morning of the preliminary championship day, I got up and I broke 100 straight in the singles event, which was my first perfect score ever. So I lost it. I'm like, oh my gosh, I broke 100 straight at the Grand American World Championships. Now, the day before, I broke a 95 in the first half of the singles event. So I knew that that wasn't going to mean anything. It was good for a pin and a handshake. Congratulations, you got your first 100 at the Grand. Really special. Now, understand, I've been told that at the World Championships, to break a perfect score is an incredible achievement as a fairly new shooter. When you start getting into the top level guys, I mean, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm not there yet. Let's just say that. So, I break the 100 straight. I'm over the moon. I can't believe I just broke my perfect score at the World Championships. They say that's a heck of an achievement. To win a trophy at any event in the World Championships is considered a lifetime achievement in the sport. Wow. To be in a shoot-off at the World Championships is considered a lifetime. I mean, it's a really cool thing. People are like, oh, if you get in a shoot-off at the Grand, that's something to remember. That's a really great achievement. To win a championship in anything at the World Championships, you know, I mean, it's the world championship. So I knew that the 100 straight and singles didn't mean a thing, except that I broke my first perfect score. So that was incredible. Then I had to go shoot the handicap event. Well, for the first two traps or the first 50 targets, I kept thinking about what the 100 straight pin from the world championships looked like. So I didn't shoot very well. So, because I kept going, I wonder if it looks just like my high school. You know, I had a high school, when I shot in high school, our coach or whatever shot his first perfect score at the Grand American. And I remember the pin and I was like, oh, I wonder if it looks like his pin. So anyways, I didn't shoot well the first 50. I thought after that, get it together. I ended up breaking the last 25 targets out of 25 in the handicap. And then came the doubles event. I said to my friends, you guys should come with me. I feel good. I think I'm going to get them all. Anyways, I step up. I break the first 50. I go, cool. All right. Job's not done yet. If you want me at some point to walk you through the psychology of that, I will. But I get ready for the second 50. And I break the second 50. And so I'm standing there and I'm going, what just happened? I just broke another 100 in the doubles on a championship Sunday, at the preliminary championship Sunday at the World Championships. I'm like, I mean, I was kind of freaking out about it. But in doing so, there were several things that happened. In doing so, out of over 2,500 competitors, there were 11 that day that broke a perfect score. I just happened to be the only one in A class on that day that did that. It's like winning the lottery. I mean, it's the odds of that, of being the only one at that level of event in that class to break a perfect score is insane, because I've often heard people say that the AAA guys, they all have to break 100 or they're not even going to place.
Right.
AA, same thing. You pretty much have to break 100 at that level or you're not even going to place. A class, I've heard, is arguably the most difficult because you've got the rising stars and the falling stars in the sport that all fall in A class. So it's anybody's game that day. And that day, it just happened to be mine. It's insane. I still can't wrap my head around that. So what makes that so special? So I'm not, when people go, you're the world champion. No, I'm not the world champion. I'm a world champion. I'm the preliminary class A world champion. The world champion, and this is what I talk about the guys at the higher level, I think he broke like 800 or 900 in a row.
Wow.
Without missing. So that's where I'm going to try to get to. But just to give you an idea. So yeah, I ended up winning the Class A preliminary doubles world championship title. And then in doing so, I didn't know this until a few days later, but I was second in the world in my class for the high all-around competition, which is the singles, doubles, and handicap for the preliminary championship weekend. It's out of 400 targets.
Wow.
And yeah, I was second in the world for that. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. But what's even more exceptional to me than that, I was told that by breaking my first perfect score that morning and breaking my first perfect score in singles and breaking my first perfect score in doubles that afternoon, that I'm the first person in trap shooting history to ever do that.
How does that feel?
I don't know. it's surreal. I just, you know, I mean, it happened. Like I said, it happened. The targets broke. The event was over. And I sat there scratching my head like, I can't believe that just happened. And then when I was told that, you know, it feels really special. What I won was cool, sure. But making history, that's, you know, I mean, that's, yeah.
It's legacy.
It's incredible. Yeah, yes, it's incredible.
Legacy. So, yeah. You and I have talked about Laney Basham. We've talked about
Basham, how
that book,
I hope
his book has influenced you a lot. His teachings mm-hmm. have. And as we were saying before, you and I have had conversations before where this mentality, like 90% of what you're doing is from this mental capacity. Yes, there's physicality, obviously. Yes, there's skill set required. But once everybody gets to a certain level of mastery as Robert Greenwood mentioned in his book, once you're there, the rest of it is, like you say, you see the target just going. It's almost as if you're mm-hmm. gliding. It's almost as if there is this mm-hmm. effortless motion.
Yes.
Can you describe to us how it was different for you this time when you were able to achieve this incredible historical event compared to other times when you would go up and compete?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you talk about what it takes to compete at that level or to do something like that, you know, again, being a natural is one thing, but I knew if I wanted to accomplish a perfect score, I had to work harder, you know? And then when I thought I'd put in enough work, I needed to work harder. And then, okay, cool. I think I'm there. I need to work a little harder. And I realized that day when I got up, and excuse me if I get a bit emotional about it, I haven't talked about it a lot. I haven't even seen the articles or anything that they posted, or any of the newspaper stuff or stuff on the news either. I haven't watched it, any of that. But that day I got up and I knew that I could hit every target that came out of the house because I've already done it. Maybe I'd never done it in 100 in a row, but I've hit every angle. I've hit all of them. You know, there's nothing that could come out of that trap house that I couldn't hit. And I knew it. And so that day I got up there, and when I walked up to the line and I got ready to shoot, I was calm, I was relaxed, and I just told myself, you haven't accomplished anything until that last target breaks. So just worry about this one and focus. And it's unlike any other time I've ever shot. Everything else, I could see other people, I could hear them, I was aware that they were there. But I was so focused on that target coming out of that house that it was almost like, I wouldn't say an out-of-body experience, but the sense of calm, the sense of confidence, but the sense of laser beam, absolute focus to where nothing else around me even mattered. It didn't matter if somebody dropped a shell. It didn't matter what happened. I was there. I was absolutely present in the moment. Everything tuned in to what I was doing with the confidence, knowing I'd put in the work to do it. And then I did. And you know that a lot of the times when you're in that situation and you know, okay, I'm down to the last one or I'm down to the last two. A lot of times that's when guys will miss because now it's in here. And that day I had the ability to go, oh, there's that transient or ambient thought. You don't belong. I'm worried about that thing, that orange thing coming out of that house and how I move and my mechanics. And I just focused on that and the thing came out and it just turned into a dust ball. And it was just one of those days where all of that effort, all of that work came together, both physically and mentally. And I was present in that exact moment 100 times in a row, twice.
That's incredible. And it's beautiful because it shows us the importance, like you say. How often, how many hours would you say you practice a week to prepare?
I can't even count it. So, you know, and if you look at Lanny Basham's stuff, and again, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. There's a part in his book where he talks about how he couldn't get to a rifle range. There wasn't one close enough for him to do live fire. So what does he do? He practiced in his basement kind of thing.
Dry fire.
So yeah. I took, yeah, exactly. So I bought some snap caps for my shotgun. And I got these little orange plastic dots that come on these targets at the rifle range, cut them in half to look like a clay pigeon, and I put them on the fireplace mantle. And so when it's minus 30 out or whatever, I'm practicing. So almost every day, I can't count the hours, but if I can go out and live fire, I do, but almost every day, at least during the season. And probably, let's see, the season starts for me here locally in April. So come February, I start getting the gun out and doing shoulder mounts and dry firing and stuff like that.
And I think that's so important because what you're describing is almost like this moving meditation, this mm-hmm. exercise and process and presence of what you're doing.
Yes.
So many reasons why people lack confidence is because they know instinctually that they lack competence in that thing. But mm-hmm. once you've done it so many times, once you've repeated the process, once it is repeatable, again, you're putting the weapon in the same position, you're shoulder mounting and presenting the same way every single time. Like mm-hmm. it is almost like clockwork. Once you've got that efficiency and there is no wasted energy. And for those of you maybe that don't, to describe it better would be, imagine the first time you swim. Imagine how you kind of flail around and you are using every muscle in your body because you have no coordination. You don't understand what the stroke's supposed to be. But then you see people at a world-class level and it literally looks like they're gliding through the water. There is zero wasted energy. There's not even like this look of, like they're not even trying hard. Their face is serene. It's very, almost like a samurai. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's what you're describing, because
yes,
even if when I speak on stage, I feel that same way. When I've sparred in martial arts, I've often seen my hand go out and strike the person before I was even aware of the opening. You just see it. And now your body just takes over. And it's very much this idea of your focus just starts doing it sort of it's on its own. And it's almost like you're not shooting the weapon, is sort of shooting itself in many ways, right?
Yes, that's exactly what happens, you know. And you get these guns and they're all adjustable and this and that. And you have to put in the time to figure out exactly what works for you. And so I had done that and I knew the gun fit me. And I'd put in the work. I'd done, I can't even count how many shoulder mounts so that I knew it was right. And that day, I didn't even think of that. It just went up and I was just, same thing. I didn't even think. I'd see the target and the mechanics were right. I think I told you one time in a conversation that I was practicing my doubles in the shower, my movement, you know, my body movement.
Yep.
And that day, all of that, again, just like you said, you'd see your hand come out before you'd even think about it. I didn't have to think about how my body moved. It just, all of it was there. The focus was there and it just naturally happened. And when I got done with 100 in doubles, one of the guys came over, he says, man, you made that look easy. I go, it actually was. And I haven't done it since.
The beauty
of
it,
you know,
the beauty of this though, is for everyone that's listening and watching, it shows that now he understands, first of all, he knew before that he had all the skills that's requisite to solve any problem. And then he's already competed on this level. So now, again, it comes back to, okay, I've already done this before. Now all I just have to do is let go of anything that's superfluous, that's not going to serve me. These, like you said, these transient or ambient thoughts, and focus on this thing. And here's the beauty of that. Again, it's like this meditation. It's like this presence where, and I believe, dare I say, when you're with the patient, it's the same thing. When you find C6, when you find that spinous and you're setting up, you connect to that patient, you feel when they're relaxed, you're telling them to drop the shoulder, and there's that instance, and now the hand just lifts the spinous on its own, and now the person receives the adjustment without any sort of pushback. And I believe it's not a coincidence that this mastery in both arenas dovetail in a way that serves you as well as the patient in the process.
Absolutely. You know, how did I describe that to somebody? You know, you put in all this work, you know how it is, you know, going to chiropractic colleges and stuff. When you first start adjusting somebody, you don't even know what you're feeling. As time goes by, as with my shooting, pretty soon you have an understanding of how all of that works and it's all in there. And what it boils down to, again, is absolute focus on the execution. Meaning, I know how the vertebra needs to move. I know exactly where my hand needs to be. I know exactly how the patient needs to feel before receiving the adjustment. I know how the gun needs to feel. I know where my head needs to be. I know where I need to be looking. I know how I need to be standing before I call for the target. And then when it happens, all of that work and all of that effort goes in to the execution. And so that laser beam focus and being present in the moment ties into execution. And it doesn't matter if it's shooting, chiropractic, rugby, tennis, golf, you know, swimming, whatever. You focus on the execution of the fundamentals, and then that magic, if you will, happens. That's what makes those people at that high level, is the ability to maintain that focus on execution every time, no matter what the event is, instead of getting nervous, you know, getting wound up or whatever. It's the ability to tune out everything and just worry about what's exactly in front of you.
And I think that's exactly, when I spoke to Emily Kwok, she's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion, gold medalist multiple times. And she had stepped up, she was an early, like really pioneer in this sport. And then as a third degree black belt, she stepped away. She had a family and she wanted to step back in. And there was that part of her that was like, do I still have what it takes? But her mentality was, again, she prepared herself physically, obviously, but her intention when she was there was, I'm just going to allow my body to do what it does. She said she literally palpated herself through whatever was there. But the beauty
of it,
right? You're visualizing the entire thing. Yeah. So for her, And when if you see her compete, it's like this surgical like aggression where she's very calm and relaxed. And then when she sees it, oh, it's right there. She just goes. And all of a sudden, before you know it, this person's responding, but they're always one step behind. They're trying to defend this technique, and she's already moved on and transitioned because she's done this so many times. She's like, once I get to this place, this person can either do A, B, or C. I already know what those things will be. And once I see that begin, I just take that, and she just occupies that space, almost like with you when the weapon, you just occupy the space of the shoulder, your eyes perfectly in line. All of a sudden, before you know it, as you say, you don't even hear the shot. You just see the dust go. And you're in that place.
You know, when it would happen for me, I wouldn't even hear myself call for the target. In trap shooting, say pull or whatever it is, for the target to come out, it was so effortless. I mean, it would just go up, and I didn't even hear myself do it. I was so focused. I'd see it, and same thing. You make that move. Same thing with an adjustment. You get somebody there, and I don't even go, okay, now it's time to make the adjustment. It's just, boom, it's there, you know? You put in enough time, you put in enough work. Anyways, sorry, I didn't interrupt.
No, you're fine. So for a person who is working on something that requires a certain amount of technical knowledge, a certain skill set, and they're beginning in it, how would you show them the process? And then what would you encourage them to do to make them get to the highest level that they can as efficiently as they can, essentially showing them, giving them the things to avoid, because there are many mistakes. People, they get in their own head, they overanalyze. In my experience, action usually cures all. If you take action and you fall down, you learned, and now you get back up and execute on that knowledge because it's fresh on your mind. But when we sit back and we contemplate and we're trying to make the perfect plan, the Marines are famous for the 70% plan, where they understand this is the mission, this is the objective, this is what we're going to do. But that last 30%, almost like in business as well, there's got to be wiggle room because the recon may be old. The weather conditions may change. There may be more people there now than we expected or less, or maybe the high value target's gone. So all these things are very important to take into consideration. But for a person that's trying to begin some sort of physical skill set, what would be your advice to them?
You know, as far as shooting goes, I've had people ask me, especially if you're just starting out, first of all, you have to find equipment that fits you, that works for you, that when you, especially in shooting, you have to find when you put it up to your shoulder and you look for that target, the gun has to shoot where you're looking. I would say that's the most important thing first. There's a lot of different aspects and a lot of different schools of training in shooting sports. Basically, in trap shooting, you have to figure out where your feet need to go, how your body needs to be positioned towards the trap house, how high to hold the gun above the house, depending on if you're a one-eyed or a two-eyed shooter, blah, blah, blah. But essentially, learn the fundamentals first. Get something that fits. Get equipment that works for you. For some people, it's a fancy gun. For some people, it's their grandpa's 870. You know, I've had my butt kicked by both. you have to learn the fundamentals first, and you have to learn what works for you. And then you have to repeat that over and over and over and over again. And so for me, what that took was, you know, I learned basically how to stand, how to mount the gun, and where to look. And then I went out and did it over and over and over again. And if my performance wasn't where I thought it would be, I would change something. And if it would improve, I would leave that there. You have to find somebody that gives you good sound information, because there's a lot of what they call a gun club good guys, you know, that have been shooting at the local club on Friday nights for 20 years. And they're pretty good there, and they'll tell you everything you need to know about shotgun shooting, and most of it's not fundamentally correct for competitive shooting at that level, you know. And so you have to get good information, and you have to get equipment that works for you, and then again, learn those basics and work. I had a young shooter one time that was doing pretty well in the state, and he goes, one day I started surpassing him. And he said, how do I beat you? And I said, work harder. You know, I don't have any more physical ability or mental ability than he does. I just work really hard at it. You know, and so anyways, I guess if that sums it up for you.
It does. And all that, and all the entrepreneurs that I know, all the people that are at the top of their game or really dominating a field, those people do not want to be put on pedestals. Those people don't want you to come up and say, because it's actually a cop out if he just says, well, you know, he's a champion. No, because now that allows them to put you on this pedestal, and now they take away all the hard work, all the time, all the repetitions, all the times you got your ego smashed to get in that position. And it also makes them, because they're doing that to save face, they don't want to acknowledge the fact that they could be doing the same thing. As a matter of fact, like you said, when you start below somebody and then you surpass them, that is often the most stinging for them, because they realize, what the hell happened? Like, I was in this place where I'm beating this person, and now they're surpassing me. What are they doing that I'm not doing? And like you said, when you start saying it's about doing the reps, it's doing the reps until you're tired, doing the reps until you can no longer do it incorrectly. So again, in the military, right? In the military, we would do stuff when you're tired, when you're sleep deprived, they would put you through shoot houses for 24 hours straight, not a lot of water, no food. It's dark, it's cold, it's wet. It doesn't matter because, and that sounds extreme, but if you were actually out there and you have to do this job, you will absolutely be grateful that you went through that preparation, because once you're there in the heat of battle and the adrenaline jumps into your body, if you have to think about what's going on or to take your weapon off safe, it's too late and somebody's probably dead.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. When you get to that level where you're tired and you don't want to do anymore, that's almost where you have to really do the work. You know, almost like you go into oxygen debt. Well, then you really got to push, you know, and that's what takes you to that next level. It's the same thing. You know, I don't want people to sit here and go, oh, you're a champion. I'm like, did you see what the world champion did? You know, I got a lot of work to do, man. I'm not there yet. You know, thanks for the compliment or whatever, but I'm not there yet. And I think that mentality too is key. You know, if I was to say, oh man, I'm the Class A preliminary doubles champion, I've made it, I'm there, I'll probably never even come close again. You know, but you got to push that aside and focus on the work and keep doing it to keep excelling. Otherwise, you won't.
Absolutely. Humility is everything, right?
Yep.
Don, I've never met anybody that's reached a high level in anything that has not gone through some sort of adversity in their life, some sort of hardship, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us about an adversity that you went through that at the time you didn't think you would make? But once you got through it and you look back on it, it gave you tremendous urgency, focus, and attention to detail.
I don't know if you even know this about me. I don't know if we've ever talked about it. I may have mentioned it, but I actually had malaria for 9 years while I was going through chiropractic college. And once I opened my office, I was very sick. I got down to 135 pounds is the lowest I weighed. You know me, so I'm not a 135 pounder. I get below 180 and people are like, you need to eat something, man. So I was very ill, and I knew that my life was in trouble. I knew that I was in danger. My response to that was to fight. So I thought, if I get below 135, I'm going to go check myself in somewhere because something's terribly wrong. But instead, the next day I got up and I said, maybe I should do some exercise. Maybe I should start trying to gain some weight. And so I started walking, and then I started running, and then I started doing weights. And it took me 6 years, I think, to gain 30 pounds, something like that. And then when I moved up here and started opening my office, I was still sick. And anyhow, I got it sorted out. There's kind of a long story there, but I figured out what was wrong, got the malaria taken care of. And I look back on that and I went, how did you get through something that almost killed you? You worked harder. You didn't sit down. You didn't go, oh man, it's over. I just can't do this anymore. I'm going to quit. I'm going to give up. I fought. I worked to get my body back to where it should be so that I could do what I need to do for people. So again, I'm sorry. This is a very emotional thing for me. I haven't talked about it a lot, but to answer your question, that's what I went through. And I use that now as a driving force. I made it through that. I've made it through other stuff. But essentially, what it boils down to is, how bad do you want it? How hard do you want to work? And so no matter what happens, when something comes up to me or something comes into my life that is adverse or difficult or whatever, that's what I do. What do I have to do to beat this? And I'll do whatever it takes. As long as it's healthy and as long as it's good for other people.
And that's the beauty of adversity. It forces us to elevate. It makes us figure out what's really important and what's not.
Yes.
Yep. Strips away all the BS in our life that we used to think was big.
Yep. Absolutely.
If we have any masks or any platitudes we're trying to prop up, they fall away because we're too tired. We're too scared. Mm-hmm. It's not serving us. And then we say, this is where I'm at. Like you said, I'm going to fight.
Yep.
Whatever I have, whatever my 100% is right now, I'm absolutely giving it to this thing.
Yeah, I hope that answered your question about that. Boy, I haven't talked about that in a while.
Well, I can tell by your response that clearly it was something big for you, but that's why we have these conversations, because there is somebody right now that's hearing this, that's going through something.
Yep.
Somebody that's on the verge of saying, I want to quit. I want to give up.
Yep.
And the beauty of this is, once you're on the other side of that adversity, all the hardship that you went through will feel irrelevant because you succeeded, yeah, because you got on the other side. And once you're there in that place of like, not just clarity and victory, but safety, now it gives you tremendous hindsight. And now you can ask yourself, because there's two ways to deal with adversity, correctly and again. Do you want to keep going through that? Do you want to keep dealing with that?
Thanks for the balloons.
I do what I can. I'm over here, yes, trying to make sure that the gestures are what they need to be.
Yay!
But that's the goal we have to understand. I thank you for your transparency and your vulnerability with this. Don, where can we learn more about you? We can go to Facebook and go to Donald J. Gibson, PLLC. Is that correct?
I believe so, yes. That's the Facebook page there. I post a few things on there. I don't post a lot of the stuff about my shooting. Other people do. But I don't. But yeah, that's my Facebook page, my professional Facebook page.
And I think that there's going to be plenty of people that'll be reaching out or following you. You may get some questions about shooting, and I hope that doesn't bother you. But I think that...
Not at all.
I think it's a beautiful martial practice that can serve anyone. Like you said, young, old, male, female, no matter how you're built. Like you were saying, that people in wheelchairs or people with oxygen tanks can still compete at a very high level. So I think that's tremendous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, again, if I could impart anybody with anything, you know, whatever it is you want to achieve, how hard do you want to work, and don't quit, and you'll get there. You will. I did.
Yeah. The only time we're guaranteed to lose is when we quit.
Yep. Absolutely. I'd love to share with you personally sometime all of the things that happened during that time as far as adversity. It's just an awfully long story, but I think it could really help some people.
We'll have you on again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Love you, man. We'll see you.
Love you too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Okta Nonverba. If this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Okta Nonverba inner circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.